Your listenership is so important to us, and we hope you're enjoying the show. If you are able to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, it would be enormously helpful in allowing us to reach more people and help them get a good night's sleep. So does following us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and any other podcast player that you use. Thank you so much for your time and support. Good evening, and welcome to the Sleepy Bookshelf, where we put down our worries from the day and pick up a good book. I'm your host, Elizabeth. It's wonderful to be here with you this evening. Tonight, we're continuing with Emma. But before we get started, I want to give you a moment to unwind and settle in for the night. Find a comfortable position and take a nice, big stretch, focusing on releasing any tension you might be holding in your body and letting your muscles relax into your bed. Next, take some deep breaths and clear your mind. Breathe in and gather any drifting thoughts from the day, and exhale fully, breathing them all away. Once more, inhale and exhale. Allow your mind to focus on the sound of my voice while we continue our story this evening. Last time, Mr. Knightley was discussing with the Woodhouses the previous evening's events, with particular compliments being paid to Emma and Miss Jane Fairfax. Soon, they were joined by Miss Bates and Jane herself, who had come to thank them for sending them a cut of pork from the Hartfield estate and to share the news Miss Bates had just received. Mr. Elton was to be married to a Miss Augusta Hawkins, the younger daughter of a Bristol merchant. Emma was determined to find Harriet before she heard the news from someone else, but suddenly, Harriet arrived at Hartfield, greatly distressed. She had been detained in the local haberdashery to avoid the rain when Mr. Martin and his sister Elizabeth entered. At first, they ignored her. Then, they both approached her in turn and behaved most agreeably towards her. She was relieved at their civility, but mortified by the entire encounter. The following week was difficult for Harriet. She couldn't avoid mention or sight of Mr. Elton anywhere she went. Miss Elizabeth Martin also called at Mrs. Goddard's and left a note inviting Harriet to visit them. And that is where we pick up tonight, with Emma advising Harriet return the visit to establish a formal relationship. So just lie back and relax as I turn to the next pages of Emma. Volume 2, Chapter 5. Small heart had Harriet for visiting, only half an hour before her friend called for her at Mrs. Goddard's. Her evil stars had led her to the very spot where, at that moment, a trunk directed to the Reverend Philip Elton, White Hart, Bath, was to be seen under the operation of being lifted into the butcher's cart, which was to convey it to where the coaches passed. And everything in this world accepting that trunk and the direction was consequently a blank. She went, however, and when they reached the farm, she was to be put down at the end of the broad, neat gravel walk which led between espalier apple trees to the front door, the sight of everything which had given her so much pleasure the autumn before, was beginning to revive a little local agitation. And when they parted, Emma observed her to be looking around with a sort of fearful curiosity, which determined her not to allow the visit to exceed the proposed quarter of an hour. She went on herself to give that portion of time to an old servant who was married and settled in Donwell. The quarter of an hour brought her punctually to the white gate again, and Miss Smith, receiving her summons, was with her without delay, and unattended by any alarming young man. She came solitarily down the gravel walk, a Miss Martin just appearing at the door and parting with her seemingly with ceremonious civility. Harriet could not very soon give an intelligible account. She was feeling too much. But at last, Emma collected from her enough to understand the sort of meeting and the sort of pain it was creating. She had seen only Mrs. Martin and the two girls. They had received her doubtingly, if not coolly, and nothing beyond the merest commonplace had been talked almost all the time. Till just at last, when Mrs. Martin, saying all of a sudden that she thought Miss Smith was grown, had brought on a more interesting subject and a warmer manner. In that very room, she had been measured last September with her two friends. There were the pencil marks and memorandums on the wainscot by the window. He had done it. They all seemed to remember the day, the hour, the party, the occasion, to feel the same consciousness, the same regrets, to be ready to return to the same good understanding. And they were just growing again, like themselves. Harriet, as Emma must suspect, as ready as the best of them to be cordial and happy, when the carriage reappeared and all was over. The style of the visit and the shortness of it were then felt to be decisive. 14 minutes to be given to those with whom she had thankfully passed 6 weeks, not 6 months ago. Emma could not but picture it all, and feel how justly they might resent, but how naturally Harriet must suffer. It was a bad business. She would have given a great deal, or endured a great deal, to have had the Martins in a higher rank of life. They were so deserving that a little higher should have been enough. But as it was, how could she have done otherwise? Impossible. She could not repent. They must be separated. But there was a great deal of pain in the process. So much to herself at this time that she soon felt the necessity of a little consolation and resolved on going home by way of Randall's to procure it. Her mind was quite sick of Mr. Elton and the Martins. The refreshment of Randall's was absolutely necessary. It was a good scheme, but on driving to the door, they heard that neither master nor mistress was at home. They had both been out some time. The man believed they were gone to Hartfield. "This is too bad," said Emma as they turned away. "And now we shall just miss them. Too provoking. I do not know when I have been so disappointed." And she leaned back in the corner to indulge her murmurs or to reason them away. Probably a little bit of both. Such being the commonest process of a not ill-disposed mind. Presently, the carriage stopped. She looked up. It was stopped by Mr. and Mrs. Weston, who were standing, speaking to her. There was instant pleasure in the sight of them, and still greater pleasure was conveyed in sound, for Mr. Weston immediately accosted her with,
"How do you do? How do you do? We've been sitting with your father. Glad to see him so well. Frank comes tomorrow. I had a letter this morning. We see him tomorrow by dinner time, to a certainty. He's at Oxford today, and he comes for a whole fortnight. I knew it would be so. If he had come at Christmas, he could not have stayed 3 days. I was always glad he did not come at Christmas. Now we are going to have just the right weather for him. Fine, dry, settled weather. We shall enjoy him completely. Everything has turned out exactly as we should wish."
There was no resisting such news, no possibility of avoiding the influence of such a happy face as Mr. Weston's, confirmed as it was by all the words and countenance of his wife, fewer and quieter, but not less to the purpose. To know that she thought his coming certain was enough to make Emma consider it so, and sincerely did she rejoice in their joy. It was a most delightful reanimation of exhausted spirit. The worn-out past was sunk in the freshness of what was coming, and in the rapidity of half a moment's thought, she hoped Mr. Elton would now be talked of no more. Mr. Weston gave her the history of the engagements at Enscombe, which allowed his son to answer for having an entire fortnight at his command, as well as the route and the method of his journey, and she listened and smiled and congratulated.
"I shall soon bring him over to Hartfield," said he at the conclusion.
Emma could imagine she saw a touch of the arm at his speech from his wife. "We had better move on, Mr. Weston," said she. "We are detaining the girls."
"Well, well, I am ready."
And turning again to Emma.
"But you must not be expecting such a very fine young man. You have only had my account, you know. I dare say he is really nothing extraordinary."
Though his own sparkling eyes at the moment were speaking a very different conviction. Emma could look perfectly unconscious and innocent and answer in a manner that appropriated nothing.
"Think of me tomorrow, my dear Emma, about 4 o'clock,
was Mrs. Weston's parting injunction, spoken with some anxiety and meant only for her.
4 o'clock. Depend upon it he will be here by 3,
was Mr. Weston's quick amendment. And so ended a most satisfactory meeting. Emma's spirits were mounted quite up to happiness. Everything wore a different air. James and his horses seemed not half so sluggish as before. When she looked at the hedges, she thought the elder at least must soon be coming out. And when she turned round to Harriet, she saw something like a look of spring, a tender smile even there.
"Will Mr. Frank Churchill pass through Bath as well as Oxford?"
was a question, however, which did not augur much. But neither geography nor tranquillity could come all at once, and Emma was now in a humour to resolve that they should both come in time. The morning of the interesting day arrived, and Mrs. Weston's faithful pupil did not forget either at 10, or 11, or 12 o'clock that she was to think of her at 4.
My dear, dear anxious friend, said she in mental soliloquy while walking downstairs from her own room. Always over careful for everybody's comfort but your own. I see you now in all your little fidgets, going again and again to his room to be sure that it is all right.
The clock struck 12 as she passed through the hall.
'Tis 12. I shall not forget to think of you 4 hours hence. And by this time tomorrow, perhaps, or a little later, I may be thinking of the possibility of their all calling here. I'm sure they will bring him soon.
She opened the parlour door and saw two gentlemen sitting with her father, Mr. Weston and his son. They had been arrived only a few minutes, and Mr. Weston had scarcely finished his explanation of Frank's being a day before his time, and her father was yet in the midst of his very civil welcome and congratulations when she appeared to have her share of surprise, introduction, and pleasure. The Frank Churchill, so long talked of, so high in interest, was actually before her. He was presented to her, and she did not think too much had been said in his praise. He was a very good-looking young man. Height, air, address, all were unexceptionable, and his countenance had a great deal of the spirit and liveliness of his father's. He looked quick and sensible. She felt immediately that she should like him, and there was a well-bred ease of manner and a readiness to talk which convinced her that he came intending to be acquainted with her, and that acquainted they soon must be. He had reached Randall's the evening before. She was pleased with the eagerness to arrive, which had made him alter his plan and travel earlier, later, and quicker, that he might gain half a day.
"I told you yesterday," said Mr.
Weston with exultation.
"I told you all that he would be here before the time named. I remembered what I used to do myself. One cannot creep up upon a journey. One cannot help getting on faster than one has planned. And the pleasure of coming in upon one's friends before the lookout begins is worth a great deal more than any little exertion it needs."
"It is a great pleasure, where one can indulge in it," said the young man. "Though there are not many houses that I should presume on so far, that in coming home I felt I might do anything."
The word home made his father look on him with fresh complacency. Emma was directly sure that he knew how to make himself agreeable. The conviction was strengthened by what followed. He was very much pleased with Randall's, thought it a most admirably arranged house, would hardly allow it even to be very small, admired the situation, the walk to Highbury itself, Hartfield still more, and professed himself to have always felt the sort of interest in the country which none but one's own country gives, the greatest curiosity to visit it. That he should never have been able to indulge so amiable a feeling before passed suspiciously through Emma's brain. But still, if it were a falsehood, it was a pleasant one, and pleasantly handled. His manner had no air of study or exaggeration. He did really look and speak as if in a state of no common enjoyment. Their subjects, in general, were such as belonged to an opening acquaintance. On his side were the inquiries, "Was she a horsewoman? Pleasant rides? Pleasant walks? Had they a large neighbourhood? Highbury, perhaps, afforded society enough? Were there several very pretty houses in it and about it? balls? Had they balls? Was it a musical society? But when satisfied on all these points, and their acquaintance proportionably advanced, he contrived to find an opportunity, while their two fathers were engaged with each other, of introducing his mother-in-law, and speaking much of her, with so much handsome praise, so much warm admiration, so much gratitude for the happiness she secured to his father, and her very kind reception of himself, as was an additional proof of his knowing how to please, and of his certainly thinking it worthwhile to try to please her. He did not advance a word of praise beyond what she knew to be thoroughly deserved by Mrs. Weston, but undoubtedly he could know very little of the matter. He understood what would be welcome. He could be sure of little else. His father's marriage, he said, had been the wisest measure. Every friend must rejoice in it, and the family from whom he had received such a blessing must be ever considered as having conferred the highest obligation on him. He got as near as he could to thanking her for Miss Taylor's merits, without seeming quite to forget that in the common course of things, it was to be rather supposed that Miss Taylor had formed Miss Woodhouse's character than Miss Woodhouse Miss Taylor's. And at last, if resolved to qualify his opinion completely for travelling round to its object, he wound it all up with astonishment at the youth and beauty of her person. "Elegant, agreeable manners I was prepared for," said he. "But I confess, considering everything, I had not expected more than a very tolerably well-looking woman of a certain age. I did not know that I was to find a pretty young woman in Mrs. Weston."
"You cannot see too much perfection in Mrs. Weston for my feelings," said Emma. "Were you to guess her to be 18, I should listen with pleasure. But she would be ready to quarrel with you for using such words. Don't let her imagine that you have spoken of her as a pretty young woman."
"I should hope I know better," he replied. "No, depend upon it," with a gallant bow, "that in addressing Mrs. Weston, I should understand whom I might praise without any danger of being thought extravagant in my terms."
Emma wondered whether the same suspicion of what might be expected from their knowing each other, which had taken strong possession of her mind, had ever crossed his, and whether his compliments were to be considered as marks of acquiescence or proofs of defiance. She must see more of him to understand his ways. At present, she only felt they were agreeable. She had no doubt of what Mr. Weston was often thinking about. His quick eye she detected again and again, glancing towards them with a happy expression. And even when he might have determined not to look, she was confident that he was often listening. Her own father's perfect exemption from any thought of the kind, the entire deficiency in him of all such sort of penetration or suspicion, was a most comfortable circumstance. Happily, he was not farther from approving matrimony than foreseeing it, though always objecting to every marriage that was arranged, he never suffered beforehand from the apprehension of any. It seemed as if he could not think so ill of any two persons' understanding as to suppose they meant to marry till it were proved against them. She blessed the favouring blindness. He could now, without the drawback of a single unpleasant surmise, without a glance forward at any possible treachery in his guest, give way to all his natural, kind-hearted civility
in solicitous inquiries after Mr. Frank Churchill's accommodation on his journey, through the sad evils of sleeping two nights on the road, and express very genuine, unmixed anxiety to know that he had certainly escaped catching cold, which, however, he could not allow him to feel quite assured of himself till after another night. A reasonable visit paid, Mr. Weston began to move. He must be going. He had business at the Crown about his hay, and a great many errands for Mrs. Weston at Ford's, but he need not hurry anybody else. His son, too well bred to hear the hint, rose immediately, also saying,
"As you are going farther on business, sir, I will take the opportunity of paying a visit, which must be paid some day or other, and therefore may as well be paid now. I have the honour of being acquainted with a neighbour of yours," turning to Emma, "a lady residing in or near Highbury, a family of the name of Fairfax. I shall have no difficulty, I suppose, in finding the house, though Fairfax, I believe, is not the proper name. I should rather say Barnes or Bates. Do you know of any family of that name?"
"To be sure we do," said his father. "Mrs. Bates. We passed her house. I saw Miss Bates at the window." "True, true, you are acquainted with Miss Fairfax. I remember you knew her at Weymouth, and a fine girl she is. Call upon her, by all means."
"There is no necessity for my calling this morning," said the young man. "Another day could do just as well. But there was that degree of acquaintance at Weymouth which..."
"Oh, go today, do not defer it. What is right to be done cannot be done too soon. Besides, I must give you a hint, Frank. Any want of attention to her here should be carefully avoided. You saw her with the Campbells, when she was equal of everybody she mixed with. But here she is with a poor old grandmother, who has barely enough to live on. If you do not call early, it will be a slight."
The son looked convinced.
"I have heard her speak of the acquaintance," said Emma. "She is a very elegant young woman."
He agreed to it, but with so quiet a yes as inclined her almost to doubt his real concurrence. And yet there must be a very distinct sort of elegance for the fashionable world if Jane Fairfax could be thought only ordinarily gifted with it.
"If you were never particularly struck by her manners before," said she, "I think you will today. You will see her to advantage. See her and hear her. No, I am afraid you will not hear her at all, for she has an aunt who never holds her tongue."
"You are acquainted with Miss Jane Fairfax, sir, are you?"
said Mr. Woodhouse, always the last to make his way in conversation.
"And give me leave to assure that you will find her a very agreeable young lady. She is staying here on a visit to her grandmama and aunt, very worthy people. I have known them all my life. They will be extremely glad to see you, I am sure. And one of my servants shall go with you to shew you the way."
"My dear sir, upon no account in the world. My father can direct me."
"But your father is not going so far. He is only going to the ground, quite on the other side of the street. And there are a great many houses. You might be very much at a loss. And it is a very dirty walk unless you keep on the footpath. But my coachman can tell you where you had best cross the street."
Mr. Frank Churchill still declined it, looking as serious as he could, and his father gave his hearty support by calling out,
"My good friend, that is quite unnecessary. Frank knows a puddle of water when he sees it, and as to Mrs. Bates's, he may get there from the Crown in a hop, step and a jump."
They were permitted to go alone, and with a cordial nod from one and a graceful bow from the other, the two gentlemen took leave. Emma remained very well pleased with this beginning of the acquaintance, and could now engage to think of them all at Randall's any hour of the day with full confidence in their comfort. Volume 2, Chapter 6. The next morning brought Mr. Frank Churchill again. He came with Mrs. Weston, to whom, and to Highbury, he seemed to take very cordially. He had been sitting with her, it appeared, most companionably at home, till her usual hour of exercise, and on being desired to choose their walk, immediately fixed on Highbury. He did not doubt there being very pleasant walks in every direction, but if I left it to him, he should always choose the same. Highbury, that airy, cheerful, happy-looking Highbury would be his constant attraction. Highbury, with Mrs. Weston, stood for Hartfield, and she trusted to its bearing the same construction with him. They walked thither directly. Emma had hardly expected them, for Mr. Weston, who had called him for half a minute in order to hear that his son was very handsome, knew nothing of their plans, and it was an agreeable surprise to her, therefore, to perceive them walking up to the house together, arm in arm. She was wanting to see him again, and especially to see him in company with Mrs. Weston, upon his behaviour to whom her opinion of him was to depend. If he were deficient there, nothing should make amends for it. But on seeing them together, she became perfectly satisfied. It was not merely in fine words or hyperbolical compliment that he was paid his duty. Nothing could be more proper or pleasing than his whole manner to her. Nothing could be more agreeably denote of his wish of considering her as a friend and securing her affection. And there was time enough for Emma to form a reasonable judgment. As their visit included all the rest of the morning, they were all three walking about together for an hour or two. First round the shrubberies of Hartfield, and afterwards in Highbury. He was delighted with everything, admired Hartfield sufficiently for Mr. Woodhouse's ear, and when their going farther was resolved on, confessed his wish to be made acquainted with the whole village, and found matter of commendation and interest much oftener than Emma could have supposed. Some of the objects of his curiosity spoke very amiable feelings. He begged to be shown the house which his father had lived in so long, and which had been the home of his father's father. And on recollecting that an old woman who had nursed him was still living, walked in quest of her cottage from one end of the street to the other. And though in some points of pursuit or observation there was no positive merit, they showed altogether a good will towards Highbury in general, which must be very like a merit to those he was with. Emma watched and decided that with such feelings as were now shown, it could not be fairly supposed that he had ever been voluntarily absenting himself, that he had not been acting a part or making a parade of insincere professions, and that Mr. Knightley certainly had not done him justice. Their first pause was at the Crown Inn, an inconsiderable house, though the principal one of the sort, where a pair of post horses were kept, more for the convenience of the neighbourhood than from any run on the road, and his companions had not expected to be detained by any interest excited there. But in passing it, they gave the history of the large room visibly added. It had been built many years ago for a ballroom. And while the neighbourhood had been in a particularly populous dancing state, had been occasionally used as such. But such brilliant days had long passed away, and now the highest purpose for which it was ever wanted was to accommodate a whist club established among the gentlemen and half-gentlemen of the place. He was immediately interested. Its character as a ballroom caught him, and instead of passing on, he stopped for several minutes at the two superior sashed windows which were open to look in and contemplate its capabilities and lament that its original purpose should have ceased. He saw no fault in the room. He would acknowledge none where they suggested. No, it was long enough, broad enough, handsome enough. It would hold the very number for comfort. They ought to have balls there at least every fortnight through the winter. Why had not Miss Woodhouse revived the former good old days of the room? She who could do anything in Highbury. The want of proper families in the place, and the conviction that none beyond the place and its immediate environs could be tempted to attend were mentioned. But he was not satisfied. He could not be persuaded that so many good-looking houses as he saw around him could not furnish numbers enough for such a meeting. And even when particulars were given and the families described, he was still unwilling to admit that the inconvenience of such a mixture would be anything, or that there would be the smallest difficulty in everybody's returning into their proper place the next morning. He argued like a young man, very much bent on dancing, and Emma was rather surprised to see the constitution of the Western prevail so decidedly against the habits of the Churchills. He seemed to have all the life and spirit, cheerful feelings, and social inclinations of his father, and nothing of the pride or reserve of Enscombe. Of pride, indeed, there was, perhaps, scarcely enough. His indifference to a confusion of rank bordered too much on inelegance of mind. He could be no judge, however, of the evil he was holding cheap. It was but an effusion of lively spirits. At last, he was persuaded to move on from the front of the Crown, and being now almost facing the house where the Bateses lodged, Emma recollected his intended visit the day before and asked him if he had paid it.
"Yes, oh yes," he replied. "I was just going to mention it. A very successful visit. I saw all three ladies and felt very much obliged to you for your preparatory hint. If the talking aunt had taken me quite by surprise, it must have been the death of me. As it was, I was only betrayed into paying a most unreasonable visit. 10 minutes would have been all that was necessary, perhaps all that was proper. I had told my father I should certainly be at home before him, but there was no getting away, no pause. And to my utter astonishment, I found, when he, finding me nowhere else, joined me there at last, that I had been actually sitting with them very nearly 3/4 of an hour. The good lady had not given me the possibility of escape before."
"And how did you think Miss Fairfax looking?"
"Ill. Very ill. That is, if a young lady can ever be allowed to look ill. But the expression is hardly admissible, Mrs. Weston, is it? Ladies can never look ill. And seriously, Miss Fairfax is naturally so pale as almost always to give the appearance of ill health. Most deplorable want of complexion."
Emma would not agree to this, and began a warm defence of Miss Fairfax's complexion. It was certainly never brilliant, but she would not allow it to have a sickly hue in general, and there was a softness and delicacy in her skin which gave peculiar elegance to the character of her face. He listened with all due deference, acknowledged that he had heard many people say the same, but yet he must confess that to him, nothing could make amends for the want of the fine glow of health. Where features were indifferent, a fine complexion gave beauty to them all, and where they were good, the effect was, fortunately, he need not attempt to describe what the effect was.
"Well," said Emma, "there is no disputing about your taste. At least you admire her except her complexion."
He shook his head and laughed. "I cannot separate Miss Fairfax in her complexion."
"Did you see her often at Weymouth? Were you often in the same society?"
At this moment, they were approaching Ford's, and he hastily said, "Ha! This must be the very shop that everybody attends every day of their lives, as my father informs me. He comes to Highbury himself, he says, 6 days out of the 7, and always has business at Ford's. If it be not inconvenient to you, pray let us go in, that I may prove myself to belong to the place. To be a true citizen of Highbury, I must buy something at Ford's. It would be taking out of my freedom. I dare say they sell gloves."
"Oh yes, gloves, everything. I do admire your patriotism. You will be adored in Highbury. You were very popular before you came because you were Mr. Weston's son. But lay out half a guinea at Ford's and your popularity will stand upon your own virtues."
They went in, and while the sleek, well-tied parcels of men's beavers and York tan were bringing down and displaying on the counter, he said,
"But I beg your pardon, Miss Woodhouse. You were speaking to me. You were saying something at the very moment of this burst of my amour patriae. Do not let me lose it. I assure you, the utmost stretch of public fame would not make me amends for the loss of any happiness in private life."
"Oh, I merely asked whether you had known much of Miss Fairfax and her party at Weymouth."
"And now that I understand your question, I must pronounce it to be a very unfair one. It is always the lady's right to decide on the degree of acquaintance. Miss Fairfax must already have given her account. I shall not commit myself by claiming more than she may choose to allow."
"Upon my word, you answer as discreetly as she could do herself. But her account of everything leaves so much to be guessed. She's so very reserved, so very unwilling to give the least information about anybody, that I really think you may say what you like of your acquaintance with her."
"May I indeed? Then I will speak the truth, and nothing suits me so well. I met her frequently at Weymouth. I had known the Campbells a little in town, and at Weymouth we were very much in the same set. Colonel Campbell is a very agreeable man, and Mrs. Campbell, a friendly, warm-hearted woman. I like them all."
"You know Miss Fairfax's situation in life, I conclude. What she is destined to be."
"Yes," rather hesitatingly, "I believe I do."
"You get upon delicate subjects, Emma," said Mrs. Weston, smiling. "Remember that I am here. Mr. Frank Churchill hardly knows what to say when you speak of Miss Fairfax's situation in life. I will move a little farther off." "I certainly do not forget to think of her," said Emma, "as having ever been anything but my friend, my dearest friend."
He looked as if he fully understood and honoured such a sentiment. When the gloves were bought and they had quitted the shop again,
"Did you ever hear the young lady we were speaking of play?" said Mr. Frank Churchill.
"Ever hear her?" repeated Emma. "You forget how much she belongs to Highbury. I have heard her every year of our lives since we both began. She plays charmingly.
You think so, do you? I wanted the opinion of someone who could really judge. She appeared to me to play well, that is, with considerable taste, but I know nothing of the manner myself. I'm excessively fond of music, but without the smallest skill or right of judging of anybody's performance. I've been used to hear hers admired, and I remember one proof of her being thought to play well. A man, a very musical man, and in love with another woman, engaged to her, on the point of marriage, would yet never ask that other woman to sit down to the instrument if the lady in question could sit down instead. Never seemed to like to hear one if he could hear the other. That, I thought, in a man of known musical talent was some proof.
"Proof indeed," said Emma, highly amused. "Mr. Dixon is very musical, is he? We shall know more about them all in half an hour from you than Miss Fairfax would ever have vouchsafed in half a year."
Yes, Mr. Dixon and Miss Campbell were the persons. I thought it a very strong proof.
Certainly, very strong it was. To own the truth, a great deal stronger than if I had been Miss Campbell, would have been at all agreeable to me. I could not excuse a man's having more music than love, more ear than eye, a more acute sensibility to fine sounds than to my feelings. How did Miss Campbell appear to like it?
It was her particular friend, you know.
Poor comfort, said Emma, laughing. One would rather have a stranger preferred than one's very particular friend. With a stranger, it might not recur again. But the misery of having a very particular friend always at hand to do everything better than one does oneself. Poor Mrs. Dixon. Well, I'm glad she's gone to settle in Ireland.
You are right. It was not very flattering to Miss Campbell. But she really did not seem to feel it.
So much the better. Or so much the worse. I do not know which. But be it sweetness or be it stupidity in her, quickness of friendship or dullness of feeling, there was one person, I think, who must have felt it. Miss Fairfax herself. She must have felt the improper and dangerous distinction.
Worse to that, I do not...
Oh, do not imagine that I expect on account of Miss Fairfax's sensations from you, or from anybody else. They are known to no human being, I guess, but herself. But if she continued to play whenever she was asked by Mr. Dixon, one may guess what one chooses.
There appeared such a perfectly good understanding among them all, he began rather quickly, but checking himself, added, however, it is impossible for me to say on what terms they really were, how it might all be behind the scenes. I can only say there was a smoothness outwardly. But you, who have known Miss Fairfax from a child, must be a better judge of her character, and how of likely she is to conduct herself in critical situations than I can be.
I have known her from a child, undoubtedly. We've been children and women together. It is natural to suppose that we should be intimate, that we should have taken to each other whenever she visited her friends. But we never did. I hardly know how it has happened. A little, perhaps, from that wickedness on my side which was prone to take disgust towards a girl so idolised, so cried up as she always was, by her aunt and grandmother and all their set. And then her reserve. I never could attach myself to anyone so completely reserved.
It is a most repulsive quality indeed, said he. Oftentimes very convenient, no doubt, but never pleasing. There is safety in reserve, but no attraction. One cannot love a reserved person.
Not till the reserve ceases towards oneself, and then the attraction may be the greater. But I must be more want of a friend or an agreeable companion than I have yet been to take the trouble of conquering anybody's reserve to procure one. intimacy between Miss Fairfax and me is quite out of the question. I have no reason to think ill of her, not in the least, except that such an extreme and perpetual cautiousness of word and manner, such a dread of giving a distinct idea about anybody, is apt to suggest suspicions of there being something to conceal.
He perfectly agreed with her, and after walking together so long and thinking so much alike, Emma felt herself so well acquainted with him that she could hardly believe it to be only their second meeting. He was not exactly what she had expected, less of the man of the world in some of his notions, less of the spoiled child of fortune, therefore better than she had expected. His ideas seemed more moderate, his feelings warmer. She was particularly struck by his manner of considering Mr. Elton's house, which, as well as the church, he would go and look at, and would not join them in finding much fault with. No, he could not believe it a bad house. Not such a house as a man was to be pitied for having. If it were to be shared with the woman he loved, he could not think any man to be pitied for having that house. There must be ample room in it for every real comfort. The man must be a blockhead who wanted more. Mrs. Weston laughed and said he did not know what he was talking about, used only to a large house himself, and without ever thinking how many advantages and accommodations were attached to its size, he could be no judge of the privations inevitably belonging to a small one. But Emma, in her own mind, determined that he did know what he was talking about, and that he showed a very amiable inclination to settle early in life and to marry from worthy motives. He might not be aware of the inroads on domestic peace to be occasioned by no housekeeper's room or bad butler's pantry, but no doubt he did feel perfectly that Enscombe could not make him happy, and that whenever he were attached, he would willingly give up much of wealth to be allowed an early establishment.
Thank you.